Thanks. Well, nice that there are so many people here. This is going to be a very informal Blackboard talk, primarily about a very old problem in linear algebra. We all know that if you have two matrices that exactly commute with each other, let's say two Hermitian matrices, and their commutator is zero, you can diagonalize both matrices simultaneously. So the question is, suppose you have two matrices that almost commute with each other. What can you do? Can you almost diagonalize both of them at the same time? So this is a very natural kind of question. I'm going to state the question a little bit more precisely, give some of the history of the results on this question, and some of the reasons you would be interested in this question in different applications in both condensed matter systems and in quantum information, and then talk a little bit about some of my results on it. So more precisely, so let's say we have two matrices, A and B. These are just n by n matrices, Hermitian matrices, for example. What's that? There will be a brief period where I will talk about unitary matrices, but otherwise they'll all be Hermitian. And suppose we know that their commutator is small. So what I mean their commutator is small, I'm going to be using these vertical lines. This is the operator norm, the operator norm of an operator. So it's just, if the operator is Hermitian, this one's anti-Hermitian, if the operator is Hermitian, the operator norm is just the absolute value of the largest eigenvalue. If an otherwise, it's the absolute value of the largest singular value, is what the operator norm is. Suppose the operator norm is small. It's less than some delta. Then the question is, are there nearby A and A prime, sorry, A prime and B prime, that exactly commute? And with this distance small, for some other epsilon. So if they're close to commuting, are they close to an exactly commuting pair? And in particular, what is the relation between the delta and the epsilon and n, the size of the matrices? So this question, there are references to it in print as far back as the 1950s, but I'm sure, I mean, it's something that's probably been considered for maybe at least 100 years. And one thing that's very easy to show is that for all epsilon greater than zero, for all n, where n is the size of the matrices, there exists a delta such that if they commute within delta, then they're within epsilon of a commuting pair. So if you have a fixed size of matrices, and they're close to commuting, then they're close to a commuting pair. So this is very easy to prove. The hard thing, so if you want a slightly formal proof of it, the slightly formal proof is, suppose not, then for some n and some epsilon, you could have arbitrarily small delta. They can commute to arbitrarily small delta, and yet they were, oh, I forgot one very important constraint. I also want to mention that the norm of A and B, let's say, should also be less than one. Then for some n and some epsilon, you could get a sequence of matrices that commuted to arbitrarily well. So we could have a sequence of pairs, AI and BI, for example, such that the commutator was less than 1 over I, for example. I just pick 1 over I, something going to 0 as I gets large. And yet the distance to the nearest commuting pair would remain at least epsilon. However, this would be a sequence in a compact space, because n would be fixed and the norm of the matrices would be at most 1, so it would have a convergent subsequence. That convergent subsequence would have a limit point, which would be an exactly commuting pair, which would give a contradiction. So it's sort of trivial to show this. And a little bit later, Percy and Shields gave numeric bounds. They determined the delta as a function of n and epsilon. Unfortunately, the trouble is their numeric bounds get worse and worse as n gets bigger and bigger. So what they were able to show is that, you know, for this n, you have to commute this well in order to be this close to a commuting pair, but for a larger n, you have to commute even more well, and so on and so on and so on. So the hard question was, is it the case that for all epsilon, there exists a delta such that for all n, if we reverse the order, we ask, is it true that for for all epsilon, there is delta such that for any n, no matter what the size of the matrix. So now you ask for uniform bounds. You want this bound not to worsen as the size of the matrix gets larger. And this question was finally answered in the affirmative by Lin in the mid-90s by a fairly complicated proof, and then Friis and Roydam simplified the proof a lot, but the proof is has a number of disadvantages. It's not at all elementary. It depends upon C-star algebras. The real downside is that the proof actually doesn't tell you anything other than this statement. They gave no information about how epsilon and delta were related. So it could have been the case that, you know, delta was e to the minus e to the 1 over epsilon, or it could have been, you know, e to the minus e to the e to the e. I mean, it could have been anything. It wasn't even necessarily a computable function. So they just had no notion about how one depended upon the other. And they had no notion of how you would ever find these matrices. They just showed that this exists. But they did at least answer this old linear algebra problem in the affirmative. So more recently, about a year ago, I was able to obtain the result that, in fact, you can do this. And it suffices to just take polynomial. So you can, in fact, take delta equal to epsilon to the sixth multiplied by some function e of epsilon, which goes to zero slower than any power of epsilon. So it was a polynomial relationship between them. This, in fact, can be taken to be 1 over a polynomial plurality. So I succeeded in finding some numeric bounds between them. So I'll be talking a bit about sketching some of the outline of how that proof went. But first, I want to mention a few things. First,
how good is this function mean?
What do you mean, how good? It's like a polynomial of the logarithm. It's not too bad.
No, it's like a continuum of a smooth or continuous.
Yeah, it's a polynomial of the logarithm.
Oh, it's a polynomial of the logarithm.
Yeah, so nothing that bad. I mean, it's slower than any. If you weren't picky about stuff like that, you could just say epsilon to the seventh times a constant. So if you wanted something that was just a polynomial. So I'll talk a bit about how the proof goes. But before I do that, I want to give some explanation of, and this will be the one part where I talk about non-Hermitian matrices, cases in which this would not necessarily be true. In fact, before Lin proved this, I think there was a lot of reason people thought maybe this theorem was not true, maybe this was not the case. And the reason is that there's a number of counterexamples to sort of natural related conjectures. So suppose we ask about two unitaries, U and V, that almost commute. Is it the case that they are close to an exactly commuting pair of unitary matrices? And the answer is no. So there's a specific example. You can write down two unitaries called basically the clock and the shift operator, if you're familiar with that. So one is going to be a diagonal matrix with entries 1, e to the 2 pi I on n, e to the 4 pi I on n, and so on. So the eigenvalues just kind of go around the circle like that. And V is the shift matrix. So it's got zeros along the main diagonal and ones just above the main diagonal and a one in the bottom corner, so it's the shift matrix. So given these two matrices, you can just go directly compute their commutator. And the commutator you'll see is of order 1 over n. So as the dimension of the matrices gets bigger, the commutator gets smaller and smaller. However, you can show that the distance to the nearest commuting pair U and V, U prime and V prime, the nearest commuting U prime and V prime, actually converges to 2 in operator norm. As n gets large, it converges to 2, so it's as bad as it could be. Like that's as far as you can be from another unit pair, is 2. So that's one example.
So
that's,
converges to 2?
The distance to the nearest commuting U prime V prime converges to 2. It's something like 2 minus some constant over n, in fact, is the distance to the nearest one. That's a lower bound you can get. Another example that you might be interested is if you go instead of 2, you talk about 3. So suppose you have 3 matrices, which are Hermitian now, A, B, and C, and they almost commute in pairs. So A commuted with B, A commuted with C, and B commuted with C. They might be very far from an exactly commuting triple. And in fact, even if I add on an extra constraint, let me add on the extra constraint that a squared plus b squared plus c plus c squared is equal to a multiple of the identity matrix. And just for reasons later, I'm going to think it should be 1/4 of the identity matrix. See if you put on this one extra constraint. There are examples of such three matrices that commute arbitrarily well and yet are far from the nearest exactly commuting triple. And
is there now Hermitian or?
Oh yes, these are Hermitian. So that was the one, everything net from now on will be Hermitian. So that's and I can give you an example. I think everyone already knows this example. So take a quantum spin S, and think of the three spin matrices for it, SX, SY, and SZ. So these have eigenvalues S, S minus 1, S minus 2, da-da-da-da-da, all the way down to minus S. They are 2S plus 1 by 2S plus 1 matrices. And let's appropriately normalize them. So I actually want to normalize them by square root of S, S plus 1, 2. So I'm going to set A to be SX normalized by 2 square root SS plus 1. B will be SY, similarly normalized. And C will be SZ, similarly normalized. So let me take these three matrices. You can check pretty quickly that they almost commute with each other. And as S gets larger, they commute better and better. Let's see, for example, A commute B. We have SX commute SY, which gives us SZ. But then we have this normalization. We have a factor of SS plus 1. We have square root SS plus 1 in each denominator. So the product of that gives us an SS plus 1. So the commutator is going to be SZ over 4S S plus 1. The operator norm of SZ is at most S. That's the largest eigenvalue of SZ. So this commutator is 1 over S plus 1 and is going to 0 as S gets large. So they commute better and better and better as S gets large. And similarly for A commute C and B commute C and so on. However, again, you can show, and I think I may show this because it's kind of a nice proof, that the distance to the nearest commuting triple remains large as gets large. So even though as S gets large, they commute better and better, the distance to the nearest commuting triple gets large, and in fact, gets as big as it could be. In this case, it's 1/2, I believe, is the distance to the nearest commuting SS prime, A prime, B prime, C prime. It converges to the largest it could possibly be again. Because you could always say 0, 0, 0 is a nearby commuting triple, and so that's and the distance to that converges to 1/2. So it's as large as it could be.
So that example clearly comes out of physics. Does your first example also?
Yeah, I mean, they're actually both closely related to the quantum Hall effect.
So how can you cast the first example in a more physical way?
If you had so I'm about to discuss, so I guess this is, I wanted to discuss two different motivations. Mm-hmm. And one comes from physics with Vinet functions, and so this has to do with coordinates of a particle on a torus. And this is really what I want to get to right now. So I want to talk about two different examples of motivations. So one motivation, I guess, should be clear. Let me give the quantum information science motivation before the physics motivation, because this is the quantum information science program. Let's say you want to measure multiple observables simultaneously. For example, you want to measure position and momentum at the same time. So you can't exactly measure position and momentum at the same time, but we do all the time approximately measure position and momentum simultaneously. I mean, I can see all of you, and I can tell roughly where you are and roughly how you're moving.
That's what it says on the speeding ticket.
Yeah, exactly. And what they do, but see what they do on the speeding ticket is they use a radar gun. So they bounce light off you, which means you get entangled with the light, and then they do a measurement on the light. And this is in fact how all measurement actually works. You entangle something with another subsystem, and then you do a projective measurement on that system. And what this gives is a POVM, positive operator value measure. It's a soft measure, a way of measuring things in a smoothed out way. And if you use POVMs, you can measure multiple approximately commuting operators at the same time to good accuracy. So if I have two operators that approximately commute, A and B, I can find a POVM that approximately measures both of them at the same time. If I have three that approximately commute, I can find a POVM that approximately measures all of them at the same time. And when I say approximately measures, I mean that it will give you values for A, B, and C, such that if you gave it an eigenstate of A, it would spit out close to the correct value for that. So you can do that using POVMs. But let's say you wanted to make projective measurements. Let's say you wanted to do a projective measurement of these different observables at the same time, say position and momentum. Well, this is actually what this question is exactly about. Is there a nearby exactly commuting pair? If you have two operators that almost commute, but you can find a nearby pair, A prime and B prime, that exactly commute, since A prime and B prime exactly commute, you can do a projective measurement of both of them. And if A prime and B prime are close to A and B, that's now giving you good information about A and B. So in the case of a spin, I can do a projective measurement that will tell me Sx and Sy at the same time. These are two exactly commuting operators and will be a consequence of this theorem. I cannot, however, do a projective measurement that will tell me Sx, Sy, and Sz at the same time. It means I can get Sx and Sy, but I can't get the sine of Sz, because once I know Sx and Sy, I know Sz squared, but I can't get the sine of Sz at the same time. There's a similar issue if another nice pair of almost commuting operators I'll talk about are these operators. One is a diagonal operator, 1 over n, 2 over n, 3 over n, da, 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 da. And the other is the operator that's a 1's above and below the diagonal. Like this, you can verify that these operators almost commute. They're commutators 1 over n. This is the Hamiltonian for a particle hopping on a line, and this is the coordinates of that particle on a line. So this is sort of energy and position for one particle hopping along a line. Since these operators almost commute, I can measure that particle's energy and position approximately with one projective measurement. I cannot, however, get position as the cosine of its momentum. I cannot, however, also get the sine of its momentum. I can only get the cosine and the position, or the sine and the position, but I can't get both the cosine, the sine, and the position. And actually, an interesting thing, if you take these, treat these as matrices that almost commute, go through some constructive stuff to find the nearby exactly commuting pair of matrices, figure out what would be a good projective measurement to do this, what you'll wind up with is a very important transform in signal processing called the Laplace orthogonal transform. Well, you end up with a slight variant of it, something a little bit different. It was invented by Rico Malvar at Microsoft. So it's actually kind of funny that this problem of almost commuting matrices comes up in so many different contexts. There it's a question of, can you find a basis to do a transform into which approximately is local in frequency, because you want to sort of cut off some high frequency behavior in your transform, and this is measuring frequency, but at the same time, you want it to be local in time so that you can do your signal processing in a way that's local in time rather than getting an entire long piece of music and then doing a Fourier transform all at once. You want to sort of be able to do a Fourier transform on the fly, but without having some edge effects between different frames. And it is possible because these matrices almost commute. We know it's possible, then we just have to go find it. And in fact, the obstructions are very important. People for a long time had tried to figure out how to do that signal transform where you get position and one momentum, e to the I, kx, and there was an obstruction to doing that, and the breakthrough was to get e to the I, kx, and e to the minus I, kx at the same time, so that you would just get this operator, but just the cosine of k, but not also the sine of k. So let me get to some applications in physics, though, of these kinds of things, and then after all that background, I have really no idea how I'm doing on time, so what's that?
Sure.
Yeah,
let me give some sort of physics applications of this, and then get into the work I did, because really I'm so far just sort of quoting old results. So one physics application. Let's say you have particles, electrons, non-interacting electrons, moving on some lattice. So you have some Hamiltonian that looks like psi dagger I, hij, psi j. So that's your Hamiltonian. Just free electrons hopping on a lattice. In many important cases, you'll find that this matrix, single particle Hamiltonian, will have a gap, a spectral gap, a band gap between different bands. So you might see that there's sort of a whole bunch of energies here, and then a gap, and then a whole bunch of energies here. There might be multiple gaps and so on. And you might ask, is there a basis of localized Bonnier functions? What that means is, let's say I have this band of energies, all the energies that fall into here. I can write down a set of states that span this band. So I have some eigenstates, let's call them, already used psi, so let's call them V of A, some eigenstates with energies E of A. Let's put the zero of energy right here. And so we can write the projector onto these states as the sum over the eigenstates, such that the energy is less than zero, of the projector onto each one. So this is just a way of writing down this projector here. But we might ask for something more. We might ask, can we find an orthogonal set of states such that when we do the sum over them like this, something other than these VA, such that when we do the sum over them, we again get the same projector back, but such that the states are local in some sense. Because these eigenstates will typically be smeared out. They might be plane waves or something else. It would be very deep over us. So we'd like to know if that is possible. I mean, there are many choices of states that will give you this. You have a huge degree of amount of freedom in unitary rotation. The question is, can you make them local? And so the almost community matrices are going to give us a way of finding obstructions to doing this. So I've written down this operator P. So let's suppose we're talking about particles. Let me do particles on the surface of a sphere, for example. Suppose that this lattice, these sites I and j, are arranged on the surface of a sphere in three-dimensional space. And so I'm going to write down some operators x, y, and z. These will be operators. So I have this matrix hij. H is an n by n matrix, where n is the number of sites on the sphere. I'm going to write down some operators x, y, and z that are the x, y, and z coordinates of each site on the sphere. So these will be diagonal matrices. And they'll just spit out whatever the coordinate of that site is. So x will be, for example, x11, x22, y will be y11, y22, y, and so on. And I will assume that a site I is located in position xii, yii, zii in three-dimensional space. Is this clear? I mean, I'm just associating to each of these points on the sphere some coordinates in three-dimensional space. I'm just imagining this sphere embedded in three dimensions. And for each site, I just say this x coordinate, this y coordinate, and this z coordinate. And then I just write down some operators x, y, and z, which,
The length of double angles?
I just say xii because.
Matrix.
It's the matrix. It's the matrix entry. Yeah, so these are matrices. It's just sort of confusing because it's so redundant. Now I can say, let's squash these operators x, y, and z by p. Since it's a sphere, I'm going to impose a constraint that for every site, xii squared plus yii squared plus zii squared is a constant. And I'll choose my radius of the sphere, for example, to be a quarter, just for simplicity of the battle. But we can scale it by anything, say a large radius of the sphere or something. And so that will imply that these operators x squared plus y squared plus z squared, in fact, just go back the identity over 4. So now we can talk about some related operators, and nice related operators to talk about are A is P, X, P, B is P, Y, P, C is C, Z, P. So these are three related operators. Now, in the physical situations we want to consider, I want to add one more ingredient. I want to assume that Hamiltonian matrix, Hij, is local, that it's local. Hij is vanishing unless sites I and J are very close to each other on the sphere. Since Hij is local, and since I'm also assuming there's a band gap, this means that this matrix P can also be assumed to be local. It decays not sharply, but has some exponential decay. So when sites are far away, P is almost local. P is local in some slightly weaker sense. Since P is local, P is close to commuting with X. Let me be clear about the scaling here. I have, say, a large number of sites on the sphere, but I've normalized the radius of my sphere to a quarter. So if I put many, many sites on there, that means that the sites are all very close to each other, and the interaction range of the Hamiltonian should be considered to be very small. So I'm sort of measuring things by the size of the system rather than by the lattice scale. And as a result, one can show, with these assumptions that this is short range and so on, that these three matrices almost commute with each other. Why? Well, simply because P almost commutes with X. P almost commutes with Y and P almost commutes with Z, and that's what it means for P to be local. That's a consequence of P being local. And since P almost commutes with X, you can check that A almost commutes with B, because you just have to commute P, X, P with P, Y, P. And you see, well, P commutes with P, P almost commutes with Y, P commutes with P, X commutes with Y, and so on. So you just go through and you see that the commutator is small. So you have a set of three matrices that almost commute. I'm going to slightly soften this. Instead of saying they're exactly equal to the identity over 4, let's say it's close to the identity over 4. You can show, again using the fact that P almost commutes with X, that A squared plus B squared plus C squared is close to P. So the sum of the squares is close to the projector. So if we just work in the space that P projects onto, it's close to the identity. So we have a case of three almost commuting matrices. If we could find a basis of localized Vanier functions, this would give us three exactly commuting matrices. All we would do is write down the matrix, write down three matrices, X prime, Y prime, and Z prime, that would be diagonal in that basis of Vanier functions, and we just measure the X, Y, and Z coordinates of the center of each Vanier function. Is that clear? So assume that there did exist some other thing, not the sum over A, but suppose it was equal to some sum over A of some Vanier functions, WA, and these WA were localized. Then I could approximate A by something like the sum over A, WA, X of A, WA, where X of A was the place where this Vanier function was centered about. We're assuming that they are localized. And similarly, we could approximate B by WA, Y of A, WA, and C by the same thing. So assuming there were a basis of localized Vanier functions, we could find three nearby matrices that almost commute. And in fact, the converse is also true depending upon exactly how you define localized Vanier function.
But sorry, three nearby matrices exactly.
Exactly commute, sorry, I said that wrong. Exactly commute, yes. Good. Now, the interesting thing is that in a lot of important situations, there's an instruction. And I guess for some people in the room, this is probably no surprise at all. So if you take particles on a sphere, and it's actually the nice thing is it's very easy to do this calculation. There's an explicit thing, which I'll show you. There's an explicit matrix you can just look at its eigenvalues. I'll show you how to construct it. It tells you whether there's an obstruction or not. If there is no obstruction, we can do the approximation. We can approximate the A, B, and C by exactly commuting points. If there is an obstruction, we can. It's very easy to calculate whether there's an obstruction or not. And so I just did it numerically, for example, for a bunch of particles on the sphere with magnetic monopoles in the center. So a model of the quantum Hall effect, lattice model of the quantum Hall effect, and there's an obstruction. So the obstruction is exactly present when there's, it's actually exactly counts the Hall conductance of the system. And similarly, you're asking about the two unitaries. The two unitaries are models of particles moving on torus. So that's kind of a very brief sketch of the physics application. So I think maybe I will also just quickly show what this obstruction is, and then I'll be kind of done with review of related stuff, and then I'll get on to end motivation, and then I'll get on to how you actually go prove the two matrix case. So for, I guess for people with a topology background, the fact that there's an obstruction is not going to be surprising at all. The interesting thing, which is what comes from either C-star algebras or this constructive approach in NLI, is that when it's absent, you can do this approximation. That's sort of the hard thing. But I'll just show you what the obstruction is. You write down this matrix. It's a 2n by 2n matrix. So what I mean is a block matrix. A is n by n, so this is 2n by 2n. You can go check that this matrix is close to its square if these commutation relations hold. Let me just check that. For example, I'll compute the upper left corner of the square. I get a half plus a squared plus b plus ic times b minus ic. That's this entry of the square. Well, that's a quarter plus a plus a squared plus b squared plus c squared plus I c commute b. And if this commutator is small and these sum to a quarter, I get back the same thing. And similarly, you can check all the other entries and find that, yes, this matrix squares to itself, almost squares to itself. If a matrix almost squares to itself and this matrix is hermitian, its eigenvalues are close to 0 or to 1. So you can go diagonalize it and take a look. So let me just sort of plot what might happen with the eigenvalues. The trace, we also know the trace is exactly n. So what you would expect to find is that there's sort of n eigenvalues close to 0 and n eigenvalues close to 1. But what can happen is that there's an eigenvalue missing near 1, an extra one near 0, or vice versa, or more than one has been moved from one to the other. So the eigenvalues are stuck near here and near here, as long as this commutation relation holds, but it can be the case that one has been moved from one side to the other side. And this is also how you prove that there's a large distance to the nearest commuting triple, because if you only change A, B, and C by a small amount, the eigenvalues can only move by a small amount, but they'd have to jump all the way across. So that's the obstruction. The tricky thing is to show that when that obstruction vanishes, so now we also have quantitative results. I mentioned the quantitative results for the two-matrix case. We also have a quantitative result for the three-matrix case. When this obstruction vanishes, which you can just count the matrices, count the eigenvalues, you can do the approximation, except that 1/6 now becomes 1/12. So the, or 6th power becomes 12th power. So the polynomial becomes worse, but you can do the approximation. So good. That's kind of a quick tour of why people might be interested. So now I'm just going to try and give some sketch of how you go prove the two-matrix case. Any questions here? Because I'm going to sort of shift gears a bit and start talking about how you prove it, and then that was kind of a quick background on a whole bunch of different things. No questions? Good. So I have these two matrices, A and B. So what I did is totally constructive, and the proof I made is kind of, I mean, it's sort of ugly because it's like a computer program. It's just, you know, it's a computer program and a proof of correctness that this will spit out two matrices, A prime and B prime, that almost commute. So let's go work in, we're going to work in a basis of eigenvalues of B. So B will have some eigenvalues, lambda 1, lambda 2, and let's order them so that, for example, lambda 1 is less than or equal to lambda 2, which is less than or equal to 2, and this is greater than minus 1, which is less than or equal to 1. So you would expect that since A almost commutes with B, if I wrote A in this basis, you would think A probably doesn't have much stuff that's far off the diagonal. After all, you know, it can't have a large matrix element connecting two very different eigenvalues of B, because then that would give a large matrix element in the commutator of A with B. After all, the commutator of A with B, if I write its ij matrix element, is aij times lambda I minus lambda j. And so if this commutator is small, and this is large, then this better be small. But we can go a bit further. We can go a bit further. And what I claim is that we can construct a new matrix, H. We're going to take A and we're going to turn it into a new matrix, H, which has a nice property that if you take H and you evaluate it between any two, what's this notation? Any two eigenvectors of B, Vi and Vj are eigenvectors of B, with corresponding eigenvalues lambda I and lambda j, that this is vanishing if lambda I minus lambda j is less than some constant, which I'll call delta, at a difference between A and H, which depends upon delta and epsilon, that is small when epsilon is small, but large when delta is small. It's it's something like, it's roughly, oops, all the way around, epsilon over delta times some constant. So that as this delta gets small, as I try to localize it more and more and say, yeah, it's closer and closer to diagonal on these eigenvectors, this blows up, but as long as this epsilon is small, it's okay. And since I'm really interested in the regime of small epsilon, I'll have some room to play. I'll be able to take quite a small delta, not quite as small. It's going to be all these factors where I say that, okay, epsilon is small, so I'll choose a delta that's still fairly small, and then later I'm going to have to choose something else that's not quite as small, and so on. That's why where you get the 6th power, certain powers just keep adding up to lose a little bit of it to go. So I'll show that you can construct this matrix. The next step after,
construct,
do you want greater than delta there? Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay. That was just a typo. Otherwise, it must have seemed very weird, right? I could pretty much be done if I could do it like that. Greater than delta, yes. So I'll show you how to do that. So that's sort of step one. And it's kind of intuitive that you should be able to do that, because as I said, these off-diagonal matrix elements are small.
Step one is define an H with this property.
Yes, defining an H with this property. Step two is going from B to a matrix that I'll call X. And going from B to X is very, very simple. I'm just going to keep B diagonal in the same basis, but I'm going to discretize the eigenvalues of B. I'm going to take all the eigenvalues, you know, minus 1 up to minus 1 plus a small number and just call them minus 1. And then all the ones minus 1 plus a small number up to twice, minus 1 plus twice that number, and group them into there and so on. So what you can think of is I can have a function from minus 1 to 1, and all the eigenvalues in here are just going to be turned into one value, where all the ones in here are going to be turned into some other value and so on. So this function just takes everything and it will just turn it into one point. So B is now going to have a discrete set of eigenvalues. It's just going to look like a block matrix. And I'm going to pick this range at which I discretize to be equal to delta. I'm going to discretize it at a range delta. And as a result, once I do that, is that discretization clear? So for example, if delta was 0.1, all the eigenvalues of B, I would just make it minus 1, minus 0.9, minus 0.8, minus 0.7, just round to the nearest 1. And after I do that, so I'll have this matrix X, which will have these eigenvalues, like I was saying, for example, minus 1. There might be a bunch of minus 1s and a bunch of minus 0.9s, and so on. What I will find is that this matrix H, because of this condition here, will now look like a block tri-diagonal matrix. So H is going to have non-vanishing matrix elements in all these block tri-diagonal like this. And it's just, if this was the point of discretization, so that you can go from an eigenvalue to an eigenvalue that's close by, but since I only change the eigenvalues by a small amount when I discretize, and because I have this nice property here, all these matrix elements of H far from the diagonal will vanish. So this is step two, is discretizing B and then observing that I now have a block tri-diagonal matrix. So I reduce the problem to two matrices, X and H, where X is a, quote, block identity matrix. In each of these blocks, it has all the same eigenvalues. And H is a block tri-diagonal matrix, block tri-diagonal. And the names X and H are sort of chosen suggestively in that you should think of X as being, again, like a position of a particle on a line with many degrees of freedom on each site, many orbitals on each site, and H as being a hopping matrix for this particle. Is there a question? No? Okay, you were looking. There is a question from Wim.
Why are they...
Okay, so let's take something over here, right? Why are these not zero? Yeah. Well, because I've changed things a little bit. So let's say I initially had some eigenvalues. So let's say I did this discretization like this. And let's say I had some eigenvalue minus 0.92 and minus 0.97. This eigenvalue minus 0.92 gets mapped to minus 0.9. This minus 0.97 gets mapped to minus 1. But if initially delta was 0.1, there was a non-vanishing matrix element between them. So on the other hand, if something gets mapped to minus 1 and something gets mapped to minus 0.8, then originally they must have been delta apart, because I only move it delta over 2 when I do this discretization process.
You cannot make the H again, a new H.
No, it's just there. The point is just that once I've made that H, then I discretize. So I suppose I could have done it in the other order too. And first discretize and show that only change the commutator small amount, and then I'd be done there. So I have this block tri-diagonal matrix H and this block identity matrix X. This is sort of all like window dressing. I mean, this is like the easy part. That is the sort of just getting to the to really trying to isolate what it is that's the difficult thing to show about this. So now I need to show something about these block tri-diagonal matrices. So step three is the hardest part, and it relies on the following claim. Given block tri-diagonal matrix J is not going to be the same as this H. It's going to be part of H. It's going to be like the first some amount of it, some portion of it, you know, some number of the blocks, not the whole, some number of the blocks. With J robust one and L blocks, then I can do something kind of interesting. There exists a subspace W with three different properties. And any two of these properties would be trivial to satisfy, and the hard thing is doing all three at the same time. Let me say them and then and write them. The first property is that if you take any vector in the first block of J, now let's talk about J. J is also a block triangle matrix. Any vector in the first block of J and project it into this subspace W, it's almost completely within the subspace W. Perhaps I should say you take any vector in the first block, you project it orthogonal to W, you get almost zero. How almost zero is, well, it goes to zero as L gets large. That's what I mean by almost zero. It's going to be L to the minus 1/4. That's going to be another place where things come about. The next thing, so if you have a vector in first block, and then you project it perpendicular to W, this is close to zero. Not exactly zero, but close to zero.
So when you say V in first block, what do you mean that the non-zero element is
zero? Yeah, the non-zero, so if the first block is, say, 10 by 10, it's, you know, the first 10 basis elements, whatever. It's okay. The first block, so the block is some, you know, some, so the yeah, it's the first block. So I can, for example, yeah, I'm just thinking of a basis which is, the basis, this block tridiagonal has meaning in some basis, that there's some basis in which this is true. And when I say it's in the first block, it's a linear combination of the first so many basis vectors. Second thing, so that's obviously trivial to satisfy. Second thing, if I take any vector in the last block, it's almost completely not in W. This is a P perpendicular, this is projected before orthogonal to W. It's almost completely not W. So far this seems really trivial. I mean, I could just take W to be the thing spanned by the first block, or really anything that includes the first block and not the last block. Now here's the tricky one. You take any vector in W, and then you act on it with JV, that's also almost in W. So you take any vector in W, and W is almost invariant under acting by J. And again, that's up to some L to the minus 1/4. Any vector in W, act on it with J, you get a vector that's almost in W. Its projection orthogonal to W is small as L, as L gets.
So you want the first one to be in W or not in W?
The first one in W.
In W.
So you start with something in W, you hit it with J, and it's almost still in W. Conversely, you start with something out of W, you hit it with J, and it's almost still out of W. So any two of these would be trivial to satisfy.
Yeah.
If you said 1 and 3, you just take the whole space. 2 and 3, you take nothing. 1 and 2, you take anything that includes, say, the first block but not the last block. 1, 2, and 3 is very hard. 1, 2, and 3 is very hard. What 1, 2, and 3 means also, it means that if I can find some W, so that if I get it, instead I write W in some way, where now this is W, and this is perpendicular to W, J is large here, but small here. This is what this condition 3 says. But this still is pretty much the first block, and this is still pretty much the last block. So all three of these are hard to satisfy at once. But if you can do all three of those, then you can do what you want to do with H. So let me explain.
Does small turn out to be 1 over L?
1 over L to the 1/4. Times a polyline.
Because it looks like you have to kind of break this chain somehow. The triangle matrix looks like a chain.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like, can you break the chain?
It looks like, you know, you need some kind of sine wave or something.
So sine, there are ways of interpolating between sine waves that work for, I erased it, but that matrix, which is just ones above and below the diagonal, that's the simplest one.
Yeah.
There's slightly more complicated things that work as long as J is tridiagonal but not block tridiagonal. Currently, the only construction for a block tridiagonal is quite complicated. And hopefully I have a little time to explain that. But let me explain why. Once you have this, you'll be done. So step 3 is constructing that. So what's step 4? Step 4 goes something like this. I'm going to illustrate it in one case. I told you the proof is a computer program in this case. Everything that comes with a proof of correctness, so it's sort of a strange way of proving things. So let's suppose that my matrix H, I'm just going to illustrate this on a very small case. This is way too small to actually give meaningful bounds. Everything's going to be done on much larger things. Well, let's suppose my matrix H was originally 8 by 8. So it had, and blocks were just 1, for example. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Like that. H is originally 8 by 8. I'm going to do 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to call this J, this matrix J. And then I'm going to again call this matrix J. I'm going to apply the limit twice, first to this matrix and then to this matrix. And I'm going to construct this subspace W for this guy. When I construct the subspace W for this guy, what I'll find is that if instead of writing it in this, or in this thing, I write it in terms of these blocks, so I'll write it in terms of So I'm going to have a W per, and this is W from this block, W per from this block. So let's say 1, 1, 2, 2. What I'm going to find, well, by what I wrote here, this matrix is going to look large, large, and then small, small. I haven't yet said anything about these off-diagonals. I'll get to those in a second. Large, large, small, small. And now I have to worry about what's going on off the diagonal here. However, what's connecting these two? What's connecting these two is these two guys. It's the only major element that connects these two. This thing connects the last block of this matrix to the first block of this matrix. So the last block is almost complete with the W perp, and the first block is almost complete with the W. So it might produce some large matrix elements here and here, but it will produce only small matrix elements everywhere else. Because, well, for example, this matrix element here is something that some vector that in this last, some part of this last block that happened to fall within W rather than W perp and so on, but those are all small. So if I erase all the small things, which I can do at a small cost and operator norm, all the bounds are an operator norm, I see that I get something that looks like this. And magically, I have split the blocks now. Now the blocks are split. It's block triagonal, larger blocks, but block diagonal. Larger blocks, block diagonal. So I'm done. And now, once I've made this change on H, I've made these blocks bigger. X is also block diagonal with these larger blocks. And then in each block, I can just diagonalize H and X and be done. Why am I done here? This is keeping track of error bounds. As long as my epsilon was originally very small, I could have a very small delta over there, which means I could have a very large number of blocks in my J, which means because of these bounds, these things could be very small, which means that all this stuff I've thrown out here is very small. And it also means, though, even though this block is quite big, if I look at what X looks like, let's go back and see what X looks like. X is also going to be something like this, up to small corrections. And within each of these blocks, X is close to the identity matrix, because each of these blocks only mixed eigenvectors of X which had close to the same eigenvalue, because the eigenvalues of X were slowly changing from block to block. So X is close to the identity matrix in each block. So now I've got it to be the case where X is close to the identity matrix in each block, and H is just block diagonal. So I can just diagonalize H in each block, and then I'm done. There I've found my two matrices. So that's the whole sketch of the proof, except for this complicated part. So let me see how I'm doing on time and pause here for more. I've talked for about an hour. So maybe I'll just say a very few words about how one actually goes about proving this result. So the proof actually relies on the Robinson Towns.
Can you remind me of P's?
Of which?
Of P's.
P is the projector onto W, let's say.
Okay.
And P brothers projector onto W. So the proof actually relies on the Robinson Towns. I'm going to sort of explain very quickly what would be a naive way of doing something that seems like it would work, and it's not going to actually quite satisfy any of these, but it's going to come very close to satisfying all of them. And then I'll argue how you tweak it, and then the tweaking is a lot more of the construction. That's the part that you can find in the paper, how you tweak it. The idea is as follows. You take this interval from minus 1 to 1, and you imagine a bunch of functions that look like this. These are sort of smoothed windowing functions. I write down a large number of these smooth windowing functions here. I'm going to call them f of n and omega, where omega is this number from minus 1 to 1, and n is just index. So this is one of them, this is another, and just indexes on them. They're chosen so that the sum of them is going to be equal to 1. But let me consider the vectors. Take any vector in the first block. Take any vector in the first block, v, and consider, and similarly, I'm going to define a Fourier transform, f tilde of n and t, which will just be a Fourier transform of this. Integral dt, e to the I, jt, f tilde of n and t. So for each n, I want to define this. This gives me a new vector which has some nice properties. First, this f of n and omega is smooth in omega, so this thing is rapidly decaying in time. You can use that in the locality properties of this j, and this is where Lee-Robinson bounds come in, to show that this vector has not been able to leak out to the last block, as long as these windows are not chosen too narrow. So it's not been able to leak out to the last block. So that's kind of going to be how I'm going to satisfy properties here. I'm going to take W to be, not really, but in this sketch, take W to be the linear combination of all these, so the span of all these vectors, for all to be in the first block and all possible n. In that case, I've satisfied property one, because if I just add this up over all n, I've gotten v back, because of the fact that they sum to one. And the last property, so I've told you that I've satisfied property one, that is correct. I've lied to you a little bit when I said I satisfied property two, I'll tell you how I lied. And I'll lie a little bit about property three. If you act on any of these vectors with j, you see that the resulting vector sits within this narrow window. It only contains eigenvalues of j within a narrow window. So j acting on it, it's an approximate eigenvector of j, so j acting on it almost gives the same vector back. So all the vectors that I've taken are almost eigenvectors of j, so you might think that the span of them is almost an eigenspace of j, but I would be lying there. And the reason is that, well, if I have two vectors that are almost invariant under j, it doesn't mean their linear combination is almost invariant. I have to worry about maybe they're close to parallel with each other and so on. Maybe they're almost degenerate. And I run into the same trouble with two. Even though each individual vector has small projections to the last block, I have to worry about properly normalizing and worry about inner products. So what I have to do in order to satisfy property two and three is I have to take this set of vectors and then throw a lot of stuff out. And then I throw a lot of the stuff out in such a way that I don't mess up property one. That's basically it. That's the whole thing, but I won't have time to get into that. So I think this is a good time to stop and take questions.
Do you have open problems?
Do I have open problems? Yeah, I
have lots of them. It's pretty big.
Well, this thing, I mean, first of all, the one-sixth is clearly a very bad number to be in there. Everyone might like it to be two. Although it's a huge advance over non-computable.
What's the best number of them?
I think two. So you'd like to do that. You'd like to connect maybe more to this fermionic case. You know, one can show for fermions moving on two-dimensional manifolds, like a sphere or a torus, I can come up with related problems of multiple commuting matrices with constraints, and then they become obstructions to that. So any obstruction to finding approximately commuting matrices becomes an obstruction to finding binary functions. But I might ask, with fermions moving in, say, three dimensions, is there any relation to this kind of multiple commuting matrices or not, or is that just completely completely a different subject?
So what would happen if you look at the monopole inside the torus? I mean, you have only two coordinates then.
Yeah, but now they're unitaries, so now there can be obstructions again. We don't yet have good non-quantitative, we don't yet have good quantitative results for manifolds other than the sphere, but I think that's more a matter of slogging than anything else, in that there are ways of taking, it would be nice to work out the details, there are ways of taking anything other than the sphere and coming up with a map, not a smooth map, I mean, sort of take a patch and map it nice enough to the sphere, and then everything away from that patch just map to the north pole in some smooth light. And then checking the obstruction there and using that to, going through a lot of work, construct the exactly commuting approximates for any other manifold, but that's really ugly to do. What happens in the sphere, by the way, is that, pointing to what used to be there, what happens in the sphere is that if this obstruction vanishes, you can use that approximate projector I wrote down to find a related two-matrix problem. And then you solve that two-matrix problem, and you turn it back into the spherical case. Basically, if that projector, if that obstruction vanishes, you can do a polar decomposition, and then you're done like that. So then I think there's a lot of other interesting things. One interesting open question we just noticed is, in physics, it's natural to think about not just almost commuting matrices, but almost commuting matrices with constraints. For example, you might think about almost commuting real matrices, or almost commuting matrices which are self-dual, or something like that. And interestingly, for example, almost commuting real matrices, three almost commuting real matrices, some of whose square is one, the obstruction does vanish, you can always approximate it. Then you might ask, well, can I always approximate it by real matrices? Or if they're self-dual, can I always approximate it by self-dual? So we found, in an analogy to the obstructions, there's obstructions known in the fermion language, similar obstructions for approximating matrices. What we don't know is whether those are the only ones for approximating matrices. So we'd like to prove, say, that given two almost commuting self-dual matrices, you can always approximate them by exactly commuting self-dual matrices. And this kind of constructive proof might be the only way of doing it, because the Lin proof really relies on having a complex having this around.
So that would mean you have like all the tensor-unit classes?
I think so. I mean, the only one where we actually sat down and worked out the obstruction was we worked it out for the self-dual one and showed that there was one. And I think it wouldn't be hard to find it for all the other cases. The hard thing would probably be to show that that's the only obstruction. There's a number of open problems, I guess, in quantum measurement. There's a conjecture of Kempe that relates to large numbers of almost commuting projectors that I don't really remember, but may or may not be related to that. So that's another problem.
So you mentioned that to five dimensions, but it seems it should be natural to generalize to even dimension and four dimensions.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that the matrix case is worse than the fermion case. When you're thinking of topological order in the fermion case, you're thinking of a system with no alternate. But if all I tell you is that you have multiple almost commuting matrices, four almost commuting matrices,
yeah,
it could be the case that it's a sphere that just happens to be described as a sphere, a 3-8. A two-sphere sitting in four-dimensional space rather than two-dimensional space.
Yeah.
So you'd have all these other obstructions, too, that could come from topological order in lower dimensions because you allow there to be holes in the system. Plus, there might be yet other ones because they're just matrices rather than. So we don't really know the full class of obstructions. I guess another interesting thing to ask about is, let's fill up a lot more. Approximation of trace norm, I think, is kind of open. Finding good PODMs, whether there really are some applications to measurement problems, whether it's just a quantum measurement problems where these obstructions do arise.
Can you, given your construction, can you find a POD?
Finding a POVM you can do directly. You can find a POVM directly.
That's right.
Without going through any of
this. That's right.
Yeah.
So
this would not
be a POVM. So what do you mean by it?
Why was I just talking about POVMs a second ago? So the interesting thing is that let's say we take those three matrices, S, X, S, Y, S, U that have an obstruction, and we find a POVM that approximately measures them. What we'll find is that sort of the measurements on the environment part of the system that has the opposite obstruction. You're kind of canceling the obstruction between, you know, the POVM, and you have to entangle it with something else and then do a projective measurement in a larger space. So you sort of produce one obstruction here and you cancel it against another one there. By, you know, by adding in these extra degrees of freedom, you produce something with the opposite obstruction, which then lets you cancel out the obstruction. So that's not a way that people naturally think of finding POVMs. Nobody thinks of finding a POVM as, now I'm going to come up with an environment that has the opposite obstruction. We just find the POVM. But it's interesting that that is actually what we would do. If you went and found the POVM that would measure this, you would construct an environment with the opposite obstruction. So it might be interesting to actually start tracking these topological obstructions through these information constructions.
This reminded me vaguely of another thing, which is that you can pack a very large number of vectors into a Hilbert space such that pairwise they're all almost orthogonal to each other. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can have vastly more than the dimension of the space.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you took projectors onto those, they would approximately commute by the this definition. So clearly, there, I mean, So, I mean, are these obstructions related, or can you relate that problem?
Yeah, like I said, there's this question of Kempe's about multiple projectors. If you just have a small number of projectors, it's always easy because the projector has the eigenvalues so far separated. But when the number of projectors becomes large, everything is open. And as I mentioned earlier, the case where you have many matrices, everything is open. And we really don't know anything. Other than stuff that looks like a two-manifold, we don't know anything about approximating multiple matrices.
And I would look closely at this construction. Would I see that of the eigenbasis of A, that the eigenbasis of B, that like two vectors team up and give one dimension in the A prime B prime? Or is it difficult?
Is he actually wanted to like show you an example where I give you the close by ones?
I'm not sure.
So the case of left orthogonal transforms, I mean, this is kind of neat. I don't know if I can reconstruct it off the top of my head, but what they were trying to do, I mean, this is a case where they wrote down a basis that was good for both. They actually had slightly different optimization criteria, but it's related. What they found was a bunch of sort of cosines that were localized around a point. For one point, a whole bunch of orthogonal cosines that were added together in certain ways. And that was one set of basis vectors with different frequencies of the cosines, so one that was also a higher frequency, a whole bunch here. But then the same thing translated over in such a way that it was here. The cosines were still overlapping, but chosen in such a way that they were orthogonal. So there'd be a whole bunch of cosines here that would be chosen, it would be sums of cosines here.
Like wavelets,
yeah, I mean it's a kind of a wavelet decomposition. So it'd be a sum. They picked for a set of discrete points wave basis vectors that were localized near those points and looked like sums of cosines near that point. This thing is here is just two cosines being together, and so they picked that for a bunch of different cosines, but then it was chosen in such a way that this one and this one were orthogonal to each other. So just to answer your question, it's not like it's, you know, one thing from one and one from the other. It's a combination of ones coming from one and ones coming from
one. So what we should think is the original problem is like position and momentum, and then the solution was these wavelets.
Yeah, and this is a wavelet. So, and the POVM case corresponds to taking like Gaussian wave packets. And this is not Gaussian. The trouble is if you take Gaussian wave packets, a Gaussian wave packet here and a Gaussian wave packet here are not orthogonal to each other. So we want an orthogonal set of wave packets. So this was some other kind of wave packet that was still orthogonal when you translated it.
What happens if the original matrices, well, it's a very different question, I guess, a bunch of them, a lot of them, they're nearly commuting, they're all positive semi-abundant, and in fact, most of the time, they're mostly all, almost all projectors. Is there a good procedure to turn them into commuting?
This is Julia Kempe's problem?
It might have been.
Okay, I have to admit when I looked at Julia Kempe's paper, I didn't quite get the exact statement of her conjecture. I'm not sure it was stated quite.
But as was pointed out, there's a cardinality obstruction. If you take too many, it won't work. Right, that was the first one I considered.
Yeah, and in fact.
Double exponential collection, but in your way of talking.
Yeah, and you could cook up things where it looks like it would work, but actually, you know, like you have an eight-dimensional system and you have n of them, but they're actually all confined to a small subspace, right? So then you're discounting this. But I don't know what her conjecture is, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really know much about large numbers. I mean, I'd really like to more understand three or four, but maybe there are interesting things in n. I don't know. At least it becomes easier if you talk about projectors. So I mean, it's a very interesting question. I don't have anything to say. And I'm not sure whether this kind of, I mean, this approach is really totally tied to two at a time. And obstructions arise, but it's what you're talking about is harder in one way because it's many, but it's easier in another way. And the only reason you'd have hope is because there are maybe projectors, because projectors, you know, projectors have their eigenvalues very far spaced, 0 and 1. So if I had gone even to this construction, not the J but the H, and I had H being block tridiagonal, if the discretization was say half, or in fact anything, yeah, half. Since the eigenvalues of this x would be 0 and 1, it would just be a block diagonal and it'd be done. So things are sort of much easier in the case of projectors because the eigenvalues are so far apart. The trouble is, you know, the thing is there's two ways to get a small norm of a commutator. One is that you have like eigenvalues 0 and 1 that are far apart and you have small matrix elements between them. In that case, all you do is you throw out the small matrix elements. The other is you have large matrix elements but between closely separated eigenvalues, and then you have to figure out how to rotate it to get them out. But then you say you want a lot of them, and then that gets hard. So you're making something easier and only harder than I think it's a very interesting problem, but I don't know. Just like.
No, actually, Lonnie and I should videotape. We wrote that.